Welcome to the first Market Dojo Procurement Podcast of 2020. I'm Peter Smith and I'm joined by Alan Rafiq from procurement technology firm Market Dojo. Hi, Alan.
Hi, guys.
So we've also got a very special guest today. In a few minutes, we'll be talking to Andy Davis, who leads procurement at London's world famous Natural History Museum. And he has an absolutely fascinating job, and we'll be asking him, amongst other things, how you go about buying dinosaurs. But before that, we've started all our other podcasts with a roundup of the latest procurement news. Well, as we record this, right at the end of March, there's only one topic really that's consuming everyone's attention and interest. The global coronavirus pandemic has brought economic crisis and a medical emergency like nothing we've seen before, certainly nothing I've seen in my lifetime. So some procurement professionals aren't working at all. Others, like those involved in health services, are busier than ever, and indeed are playing vital roles in the response to the crisis. We've seen the army in the UK being brought in to help with the logistics around distribution of protective equipment and clothing to medical staff. Other supply chains, such as for food and pharmaceuticals, are also strained. And again, really important work is going on there with procurement and supply chain people right at the centre of that. And we send our best wishes to everybody, really. In the medium term, as business starts to pick up again, procurement people are going to be focusing on simply ensuring supply, we suspect, to begin with at least. Some firms won't recover, so we'll have to look out for suppliers disappearing, and I suspect inflationary pressures may well build. I'm also worried that if everyone starts conserving cash and delaying payments to suppliers, there could then be another wave of bankruptcies. But then maybe this means it's finally the time for supply chain finance to take off in a huge way. And I'm sure there'll be other changes too and some positive developments. And in the medium to long term, it would be good to think that there'd be more focus on understanding our suppliers, understanding risks in the supply chain, and perhaps more focus on sustainability issues too. However, we didn't want to spend this entire podcast talking about the pandemic, so we will move on. But first, Alan, anything you want to add? How's all this affecting Market Dojo?
Thanks very much, Peter. It's been a bit strange. We come off the back of our best quarter ever with a really nice kind of forecast before this crisis hit really hard about a month ago. And given our position and helping people with the supply chain and working virtually, it puts us in quite a unique position. We've developed an RFI, free RFI for people to use, advertised on our blog to help people understand the risks in their supply chain. But you know, you can't get away from the fact that a lot of people are running around like headless chickens trying to save businesses, obviously. We've written a few blogs on how we're dealing with it at Market Dojo. You know, I think there's some sensible steps everyone needs to take in this crisis. I mean, the paramount is communication internally and externally, maybe creating some kind of central points of contact to analyze your short-term and medium-term payments going out and contracts is key, followed by, you know, a risk analysis on our supply chain, on people's supply chains, and trying to work out disaster recovery plans. And I think this understanding of information will be key moving forward to be able to react in the medium and long term. We've seen a lot of collaboration with suppliers, both for our own actions and with our clients, to understand how people can share the risk moving forward. You know, we started off offering e-auctions, but now we're more about supply chain information and making the right decisions. However, we are seeing a few cases when auctions are being run where suppliers have taken advantage of the situation with some clients and hiked the prices up massively. So that's an area where some virtual negotiations have been very useful. But above all, I think procurement is really coming to the forefront as saviors of companies at the moment, and dedicating tasks to people within the procurement profession, I think, is very important within companies to make sure that this is tackled in an organised way. So it's a bit bittersweet in some ways, but you know, we'll do what we can do to help. And back over to you, Peter.
Thanks, Alan. So yes, moving on now to our special guest for today. I first met Andy Davis when he was head of procurement for Surrey County Council and also member of the SIPS Council and then board. Before that, he started on what was then the quite famous London Underground Procurement Graduate Trainee Scheme. And then after Surrey, he worked in various senior roles in the public sector with councils, the police and fire service, then became CEO of the London University's Purchasing Consortium. In October 2018, he took on his current role, leading procurement at one of the world's greatest museums. It's no exaggeration to say that, the Natural History Museum in West London. So welcome to Andy. We'll start with a couple of quick career questions first. You have a bit
Hi,
of an
Peter.
Unusual... Hello, Andy. Hello. You have a... Sorry, I should have said hello earlier. You have a rather unusual degree for a procurement leader, don't you?
Well, I said, you know, I think back in the 1880s when we were younger, I think there were lots of people in procurement that came from all different sorts of walks of life and different educational backgrounds and so forth. So I'm not sure that it is that unusual, but I mean, I studied architecture at a well, what was quite a good school of architecture actually in London. But I found during the course that the career as an architect wasn't for me. Although I'm still very interested in the subject, Peter. In fact, when I retire in a few years' time, I do plan to resume my my education in it. Hopefully, I'm going to do an MA in architectural history and follow the steps of my my brother, who's an architectural historian. And I have on occasions, you know, taken my interest further. A couple of years ago, I did a conversion course that allows me to do this MA in architectural history when I retire. And whilst I wrote a thesis about a university building in London, and I even gave tours of it to people who were interested. So yeah, I've even been a tour guide. So I suppose that's unusual.
I say yes, a little unusual. But coming back to the current role, I remember when you took it, by some metrics that we tend to look at in procurement, like annual spend or how many people directly reporting to you, it didn't seem as big a job as the university's role. So why did you take it on?
Well, there are actually several reasons. The main reason being that I wanted to have it was a life choice. I had had 9 years as director of the London University's Purchasing Consortium, a role which I enjoyed immensely. I had a great time there. And I came to a point in my life where, you know, I paid off the mortgage, the kids had grown up and left home, and it gave me a chance to think, well, I can now be a bit more choosy about what sort of work I want to do. I'd always wanted to work for a museum. In fact, about 25 years ago, I think I'd applied for the head of procurement job at the Victoria and Albert Museum and came second to my bitter disappointment at the time. So it was good to have another crack when the job at the Natural History Museum came up. And I was fortunate enough to be selected for that, and I'm having a great time. There are lots of differences, as you might imagine, not least the spend and the size of the team and so forth, and the salary, I might point out. but you know, it's the sort of job that I meet many people who would like to swap places with me, and it's quite a nice job to have.
And I suppose at this point we should touch on the elephant in the room, as it were, but. Although actually you do have an elephant in the room, don't you?
Yes, we do, yes.
Yes,
in
yes.
The mammals gallery.
I think yes, just my little joke there. So seriously, back to the other elephant. How has the pandemic affected you and the museum?
Well, sadly, we did, of course, have to close our doors like all other museums in the country, I imagine, by now. That was a very sad move we had to make. I suppose what we're concerned with now is how we can safely and efficiently reopen, and how do we gear up our operations in order to be ready for reopening at the earliest possible time. Well, we're planning a major exhibition, which is going to open in the summer, all being well, and remobilizing our caterers, our cleaners, our security people, and engineering it's like having a project in itself is gearing up for reopening, and that's a very important activity for us, and it's an important activity for me in procurement. To help those who manage the relationships with our critical suppliers and ensure that they're all lined up and mobilised, ready to reopen when conditions allow.
That's a good point, actually. I hadn't really thought about that. So I guess everyone's been focused on sort of closing things down, but that looking ahead to getting going again will bring its own challenges, I guess, as well. Yeah, interesting.
Yes, I mean, what has helped actually is the government's coronavirus job retention scheme has helped enormously with that, because without that, we were faced with some contractors who were on very thin margins, you understand, in this day and age, in hard and soft FM services and in catering and security and so forth. And they were faced with museum closure. We weren't going to be able to pay our workers. We weren't going to be able to pay the operatives working for those contractors. And without the job retention scheme, it would have been a real headache. But I think that has certainly been a major help, I have to say.
Good. And will this change your focus at all once we're back to something like normal life?
Well, one thing I am proud of is the fact that our small procurement team has been instrumental in having conversations with our critical suppliers about winding down for closure and on being ready for the future. And that's a position I want procurement people, and I very much believe procurement professionals should be in. And that is on managing at the very cutting edge of risk management and operational management, and recognizing that we've got an important contribution to make our profession from that angle, and quite a unique one, where we're managing relationships with key people who are going to be absolutely fundamental to opening the museum at a time when we can and as early as we can, and to getting our visitor numbers back up to 5.4 million a year or whatever it is that we're at. It's absolutely crucial, and I want to make sure we keep that position.
And I know that some of the key people who manage those big critical contracts in the museum don't report to you directly. They have a sort of dotted line, I believe. So how have you made that work? Because that can be a tricky situation for a procurement head.
Well, I think some of that has been about creating a cadre of contract managers, if you're a sort of fraternity where people can learn from one another about the best ways in which to manage commercial relationships and to manage performance and so forth. So we've got some really good people. We've got some great people who have lots of experience and lots of capability in this area. And we have other people who are managing contracts who are less experienced, but they're able to learn from their colleagues a great deal. And we've been able to run a couple of more than a couple of seminars where we've been able to share that experience, and people have been able to talk through their problems, and it's been extremely useful.
So moving on, I know this is a topic close to your heart. You've been interested in the wider issues around sustainability, procurement with purpose, yes, whatever we call it, for a long time. So perhaps can you start by saying a bit about Electronics Watch?
Well, Electronics Watch is a very important organisation for us and for other public authorities right across Europe. We, as an organisation, we feel very strongly that we want to protect and promote respect for human rights in our supply chains. And there are, as you know, there are a number of categories of spend that present higher risks of abuse of human rights, and electronics is one of those areas. There's quite a lot is written and quite a lot seen in the media about working conditions for workers at all points of the supply chain, right from mining for raw materials in Africa, right through to final assembly in the Far East and in Eastern Europe and in Latin America. And the problem for us as a public authority is that on our own, we cannot hope to be able to monitor supply chains for human rights abuses. But what we can do is to do things collaboratively. And Electronics Watch is a collaborative non-profit organization which exists to do exactly that. It's not involved in campaigning or anything like that. Its sole job is to monitor global electronic supply chains for human rights abuses and produce reports and risk reports on where workers' conditions can be better protected and respect for human rights can be better promoted. And that's something that that we are very proud to be a part of. In practical terms, what it means is that when we make purchases for anything from desktop PCs to networking equipment or servers and storage, whatever you like, then we are able, through framework agreements which we participate in, to get our suppliers to comply with certain conditions of contract, which mean that we pass addresses of factories where our equipment is made over to Electronics Watch, and they add it to their portfolio of information and can use for us risk reports and monitor those supply chains. It's extremely useful for us. We'd like to see it in other risk categories, actually, that sort of approach.
Interesting. And I think in the university sector, I remember you saying to me, there are some stories about sort of human rights abuses involving students and school children, even in certain countries. And that had a particular sort of resonance in the university sector.
That's right. In the universities, we managed a framework agreement for servers and storage. And we had an example of a factory in Guangdong province in China, where it was discovered that the local factory was relying on a local vocational college to provide young people of 16 or 17 years old. So it'd be sort of sixth form age, if it is what we'd be more familiar with. And these kids were studying agriculture, and we understood that they were being required by that vocational college to spend 6 months or more on the production line, manufacturing servers. And of course, what Electronics Watch, their values are very, very important. It's very important that for us to get involved, we need to understand that it's our kit that's being manufactured. And this was a very real case where our original equipment manufacturers were able to tell us that yes, indeed, our servers were being manufactured in this factory in Guangdong province. And to their credit, they were able very quickly to send in auditors to establish that that was in fact what was happening, that these kids were actually being they were being paid a minimum wage, but they weren't receiving social benefits to which they're entitled under Chinese labor legislation. Mm-hmm. And what the most important of all was that the young people were being threatened with menaces. In particular, they were being told that they would not be able to graduate. They would not get their certificate unless they did this 6 months on the production line. Contrary not only to common sense, but it's contrary to Convention number 29 of the International Labour Organization's conventions, and therefore was quite illegal. Electronics Watch were then able, a few months later, to send their own auditors into that factory and ensure that the cessation had been for keeps, if you like, and that those young workers were being protected. But this is tip of the iceberg stuff, Peter. Kind of situation is commonplace in China and in other countries, and it's a major job which Electronics Watch has to do.
And what about at the museum? What sort of sustainability issues have been on your agenda in this role?
Well, early this year, the museum published a brand new organizational strategy, which has a vision for a future where both people and planet can thrive. And one of the things that we want to do, our main mission in life, if you like, now under this strategy, is to create advocates for the planet. That's advocates for the planet from our 5.4 million visitors that visit us every year at South Kensington and at our satellite museum at Tring, but also as a world-class scientific research centre. It's in all the dealings that we have with other museums and research establishments all over the world, and to encourage them to help join us and join others in our response to the planetary emergency that faces us. And in procurement, I'm a strong believer that chapter one, page one of the procurement textbook, and by that I mean, you know, our kind of the one that's in our mind, all our minds, that says, doesn't it, that our strategy needs to tie in with the strategy of our employing organization. And I hope you still believe that, Peter. I certainly do. And therefore, the main thing I want to achieve is that we secure from our supplier community, and also our supplier, our community of partners and suppliers and contractors, that they all become advocates for the planet, and that they do that in a demonstrable, a real demonstrable way. And I've seen quite a lot of conversations during this pandemic crisis. I've seen a lot of people talking about corporate social responsibility and how we might find that this sorts out those organizations that really mean it when they talk about social responsibility and what companies can do for the environment and what they can do for wider society. And I think that one of the things that this crisis might well show us is those that are truly serious about that. And those are the suppliers that we want to talk to in and be associated with our museum.
And that comes down to at a level of detail. Presumably the stuff you're selling in the museum shop, you've got to look at plastics and that sort of thing.
That's right. All those terrific dinosaurs, the plastic dinosaurs by in our and in fact one of the things we wanted to focus talking about human rights in the supply chain, one of the things that I introduced in my first few months there was the SEDEX platform for sharing ethical data between buyers and it's mainly used for garments. So a lot of the high street chains use the SEDEX platform, and with reason. I mean, you'll remember all of the media reports about human rights abuses in garment workshops and you know, sweatshops, as you might call them, throughout the world, producing garments for consumption in a lot of Western countries. And you know, we're selling T-shirts in our shops. We're selling our front of house staff wear a uniform. I was very conscious of the fact that our contractors wear uniforms with our logo on it as well. And that what we are saying to our visitors is that we want to make sure that those garments are manufactured in factories that are transparent about their working conditions. So I signed up to using SEDEX so that we could use suppliers of garments that were regularly audited. Now, Peter, that's not to say that auditing is a perfect way of doing that. There are drawbacks with auditing, as we know, but for the moment, at least, that's the best tool that we have readily available to us. And what it does do is it makes our supply chains a lot more transparent than they were before. And we also had a new head of buying and merchandising, a lady called Laurie Rankin, who joined the museum from the John Lewis partnership, actually, where John Lewis had been used to using the SEDEX platform. And she's just completely run away with it, actually. And in fact, has signed up dozens and dozens of our suppliers of toys and souvenirs and a lot of other things that you can buy in our many and wonderful shops museum now. And more and more of those are now coming from factories all over the world where there's a lot more transparency. And we can say with a lot of certainty that factory auditing to an international standard is being undertaken, and that proper corrective action processes are in place for when shortcomings are found in those factories. And that's given us a great deal more confidence, and that's a confidence that we can pass on to our visitors in the museum, and that's of enormous value to us.
Excellent. So while we're talking dinosaurs, I hear you might be in the market for something a bit bigger than the normal little plastic models. Is that correct?
Well, that's true, actually. One of the things that I I didn't believe I would ever get involved in when I joined the museum less than 2 years ago. I didn't think I would ever be involved in contracts for actual dinosaurs. But actually, I'm on my third at the moment. I should stress that we don't believe in sustaining a market for actual fossils or specimens which have of scientific interest, because we don't feel that that's, you know, having inflating prices on a market for specimens in that way, by creating that sort of demand for it through auctions or whatever, we don't believe that that's good for science. But what it is important is being able to acquire a cast, let's say, of a skeleton, perhaps of a prehistoric creature. For example, we've got one on that's going to be going on display in our exhibition that we're opening in the summer, all being well. Unfortunately, because of the pandemic crisis, our cast of that dinosaur's still stuck in the museum in Colorado at the moment, but I'm sure we'll get it moving in due course. Similarly, also, we have a major project called the Urban Nature Project, which is redeveloping the gardens outside the museum next year. And this is going to involve, we hope, some placement of bronze specimens of potentially larger dinosaur specimens out in the gardens as a very important feature, and which we hope will become a London landmark over generations to come. And so we've published an ODU notice now for new creatures, new specimens that are going to be manufactured from bronze. And that's going to be a very interesting project, trust me, and one that I'm very proud to be involved in. And it gets me out of bed in the morning, Peter, I'll let me tell you. It's just the sort of thing that really, really fires up my interest. And we hope to get a lot of interest from foundries around and about in getting into making those models for us.
Excellent. I'm just wondering whether anyone has a regular search set up on their ODU monitor for dinosaurs, you know, whether anything has ever come up under that search before. So, but no, that sounds fascinating. I'll shut up for a moment and hand over to Alan, who I think has got a couple of questions. Over to you.
Yeah, so it's really interesting to hear from you there, Andy. I think that electronics watch scheme sounds like something to pick up upon. It sounds doing a lot of the right things there, and yeah, it's interesting that
thanks,
you
Alan.
No, I mean, really interesting. I think you're leading the way in a lot of these kind of scenarios, and interesting that you were looking to be an architect. It was one of my first. I ended up being an engineer, but that was what my first thing was to be an architect actually as well. And I wasn't sure if it was an elephant in the room or a room full of elephants. I'm still trying to work that one out. Yeah, no, fantastic. I mean. Is there anything else in particular that you've done in the museum that you're particularly proud of? I mean, it sounds like you've got lots of interesting things going on there in terms of sustainable supply chains. Was there anything else that you might want to allude to?
Well, one of the things that I hadn't really expected quite so much was that, and being a procurement professional of three and a bit decades now, and having I've got quite a lot of experience under my belt. And one of the things I hadn't really appreciated was how many young people there are working in the museum and who get involved in all of our behind the scenes activities, and that will involve spending money and entering into contracts for all sorts of goods and services. And one of the things that has just been it's been working with people with a lot more energy than I've got, but hopefully I can match them on enthusiasm. And it's one of the most enjoyable things is being able to offer, the benefit of experience and having been round the block a few times in all sorts of problems or disputes or finding out how to solve issues and on giving people the benefit of that. has been, it makes the job very rewarding for me, and it was something I didn't really envisage might happen. It really is, from day to day, it's a very enjoyable role, and I work with a lot of very talented people, and I just hope that as a result of this, people who traditionally haven't believed that procurement can contribute to the day-to-day, not just the day-to-day operation of the museum, but also in thinking about what are the key risks which the museum faces, and what are the sensible mitigating steps that we can put into place to help manage those risks. I'm hoping that the people I work with have a larger view of procurement than they had previously.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's very rewarding when you can help mentor kind of say a younger generation with your experience. And I mean, I have kind of on that and a similar vein and looking to the future. I mean, one of the challenges that we find at Market Dojo is working in procurement and supply chains and try to provide the right tools. I think one of our biggest competitors has always been emails and spreadsheets. And we've always been driven to get people to understand the data so they can understand and mitigate risk more quickly, which has come up, you know, in this time of the crisis is one of the key things to be able to react. Do you think, looking to the future, that, you know, I always put the analogy to the finance people have finance systems, sales people have sales systems. The word mandate isn't used, but they all use these systems. Procurement seems to be an exception. Do you think when we move forward after this crisis, there'll be a much bigger drive and acceptance within procurement to actually have the right systems to maintain these virtual supply of information to allow them to mitigate risk more easily? Or do you think it will just fall back into day-to-day, you know, business as usual and emails and spreadsheets and data everywhere?
I don't think we're going to have a choice, are we, Alan, really? I mean, the onset of artificial intelligence will be such that in the very near future, if not right now, we have the capability of all of our transactional tactical activity being automated as far as it possibly can. And that's going to be tremendously useful for an organization like mine, where we have a regime of devolved procurement responsibility. You know, we have a very small central team which supports the organization, and we like to think that we give valuable advice and experience to help people manage the major risks. But when it comes to buying goods and services, we just want to make sure that happens as smoothly and as effortlessly as possible, and that's where we look for the technology to make the difference, I suppose, and that's only going to keep moving in the right direction. What that does mean is that procurement needs to focus on its role being, like I say, getting more into the problem solving and risk management part of our profession, where I like to think human beings still have the edge over the technology in being able to do proper options analysis to support projects and ensure that we go for the optimum route and take calculated risks in order to go the optimum route to achieving our goals. That's the best I think that our profession can offer going forward with the support of technology.
Absolutely, I'd agree with that. It'd be interesting to see how, you know, after staying safe and how we come out the other side of it. Thank you ever so much for that, Andy. It's been a real pleasure listening to you. I think, but Peter might have a few further questions or wrapping up.
Thanks, Alan.
Yeah, you covered a couple of things I was going to ask you there about the sort of future procurement, and obviously you're sounding quite optimistic there, I think, about the profession and the role of procurement. If there's one thing you could wave your magic wand and change or make happen to sort of assure ourselves that procurement does have a great future, what would that be?
Oh, that's a thing I could change. I think it might be that the one thing I think in our profession that we need to get better at, and maybe it's something I need more help with, is communicating the the message more widely. So it's, and it, you know, I talked, didn't I, about what my hopes were about how people might change their impressions about procurement. And there are still, aren't there, we're still faced with a challenge when it comes to, you know, are we just about shopping, or are we just about, particularly in public service, you know, are we just about compliance with the regulations? You know, compliance, being compliant with the regulations is very important. I don't want to decry any of that, but there's so much more that we can offer as professionals. And it's overcoming those obstacles about communication and carrying forward that message. And sometimes I feel we can when we can devote the time to it, we can invest that time in it. But I do think sometimes we might learn more from our marketing colleagues about how to promote procurement. All still in the procurement press, you read about our desire to be at the top table, to be in the C-suite. I think I've heard that debate ever since the 1880s when I started on this journey. I'm sure you'd feel the same, Peter. And the very fact that we still have this PR problem, that would be the one thing I'd like to overturn or see it turned. I don't know whether I could do it, but it's something that I would like to, once and for all, for our profession to put to bed by, you know, really proving our worth in organisations.
I think that might be something for our daughter's generation rather than ours, Mr. Davis. but yes, that's, and perhaps that's a topic of another podcast, because it's certainly something we could talk about for some time. But we've run out of time for today. So thank you so much to Alan and to Market Dojo for developing this podcast and supporting it. But particular thanks today to Andy Davis. And when things get back to normal, we do urge everyone to get along to the brilliant Natural History Museum and support it. So goodbye from me. Goodbye from Alan.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Andy.
Thanks for having me, and goodbye.
And if I can just say from all of us, our best wishes to everyone listening, and good luck over the next weeks and months. Thanks.